Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Business Beyond Performance podcast. That is my beautiful and gorgeous co-host, Matt Powell. I am the average Joe Staub, and here we are.
Fantastic intro as always, buddy.
So yeah, try and mix it up a little bit, you know?
So this guest is definitely right up your alley, man. I'm so happy you got him on. He is a former strength coach. He did a lot of basketball. Obviously, you were at a couple of big basketball schools between UConn and Kansas. He did a fantastic job of taking those experiences and turning it into a multi-hundred million dollar business with a huge capital raise for not only his A, but also his B. So just a huge accomplishment to get him on, and I'll let you say more about him, please.
Yeah. So Josh Bonitol is someone who is about my age, and I knew through the circles, again, the way the network works. You know, he was up with Boyle at one point, so I knew the name because he was in my area. I'm originally from that Boston area, and then, you know, we kind of went our separate ways. He went into basketball, worked up in his way to the Bulls, and then was then over at Purdue. I, you know, heard the name, knew the guy, you know, Chris Chase, a mutual friend of ours, knows him well, and then, you know, as I left the strength and conditioning side as a coach, getting into the business side, working with some of the product companies, you know, was able to connect with him at the Final Four in San Antonio. I believe it was 2018, it might've been 2017. And me and him had he finished his speech and me and him had a really good conversation at the conference they host right in par with the Final Four. And then that like 10-minute conversation turned into an hour later in the day, turned into us calling and texting and keeping up, you know, lending each other advice, then him getting out of the coaching world. And then now for the last, you know, what is it, 4 or 5 years, you know, text back and forth, phone calls back and forth. I even one time traveling flew, I was a West Coast, flew down to San Francisco, met him for a cup of coffee, hung out with him for an hour, checked out Future, and then flew back out. So just a really cool guy, someone who I vibed with from the beginning I met him, and also someone who had that vision to take everything he did in strength and parlay it into something else.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, Josh Bonitol started or was a major component or a founder in the company Future. So that's the Series A and Series B funding we were talking about. And what Joe was just mentioning there, this is becoming a nationwide and almost worldwide at this point, or will be soon, phenomenon. These are online coaches who are being paid real people's salaries, crazy thought, to do their job and also do it from home during reasonable hours, not having to go from 5 a.m. till 7 p.m. like some of the smaller D1 schools that are out there, or D2 or D3. So just something to really consider about this is somebody who's come from our background and then grown themselves into a true business person, got the right mentors, did the right steps, as you'll hear today on our episode, and got himself to a position where he could go on to become a huge management person.
Yep, no, and one of the other things that this ties in, and Josh even talks about it, is it ties into things, you know, Dr. Megan Sullivan and Andy Rise talked about it in previous episodes, is, you know, the mental performance and the mental skill set. Josh was a guy who was a strength coach at, you know, the Bulls and Purdue. No reason to go to a technology conference, no reason to go into Silicon Valley, no reason to do the things he was doing. But he went out on a limb, he did, he started meeting people, and he was able to take those connections because he put the work in, he took a chance on himself. So again, if in this conversation, while we get into kind of his story and his business, at the heart of it, it's a guy who took a chance on himself in an industry where most people would say, I'm not doing that, or why would you do that? So go back to those other episodes of Dr. Megan Sullivan and Andy Rise, because that's a great, you know, a toolkit development to be able to do the thing Josh did, which is go out on a limb and, you know, make something of it, which it's been awesome to see.
Hey, so the other thing you brought up, Joe, that was fantastic is, yeah, he did absolutely bet on himself and he was able to put all those pieces together like we talked about in episode 0. So for any of you listeners out there, please check out Future. Josh has done a fantastic job building that with some amazing tech people and mentors. And then also check out episode 0.
Yep. And without further ado, episode 8, Josh Bonitol. Want to say thanks to our sponsor, Strive. Nicole and the team at Strive have done what I think helps kind of close the gap in wearable technology. by being able to measure the actual muscular effort or the internal load of the body and comparing that to all the external load, you know, speed, distance, G-force, that someone is producing, you actually are able to see not only what someone did, but how they did it. And that how has been the secret sauce and the missing piece in my mind. It's kind of where the wearable technology needs to go. It's the integration of multiple monitoring modalities to derive a holistic measure of what someone did and then how they did it, which at every level, from the sport coach to the strength coach, to the athletic trainer, even to the administrators and the insurance billing and understanding why and what's happening when people get injured. It's literally a revolutionary thing. So definitely something you should look into. Wearstrive.com. That's WEARSTRIVE.com. Want to give an unofficial sponsorship shout out to Dr. Jim Stepani, Dr. Tim Sheets, and Vince Andrich, the later of the two who have both already been on the podcast, and JYM Supplement Science. So JYM, kind of like Jim with a J, Supplement Science.
Yeah, absolutely. Great product. Something that we definitely have been used quite a bit over the years. Great protein. And the thing that we both really appreciate about them is they actually have research behind everything. Dr. Tim Sheet, as you mentioned, who's been on the podcast before, went through and explained how they actually do the research, unlike most companies in the supplement industry. And they actually give out information that makes sense, and they help people decide what supplements are best for them, even if it doesn't mean they go with their company. But they prove time and time again that science and the research behind it are the reason why these supplements work. And then they give those, you know, powering statements and empowering movements to help these people make the best decisions for them and their individual needs as a consumer.
No, and again, never hurts that they're UConn guys either. but no, definitely JYM Supplement Science. Check them out. Again, it's top quality products with the research to support them. And if it's a brand you're not familiar with, it's something you should be familiar with either yourself or your athletes.
For sure. Joe, if there is one unofficial sponsor throughout our entire podcast, all the episodes we've done so far, I think we're up to like 15 by now. Who would you choose?
Well, Matt, we're actually up to 19. And the reason I know is because I write it all down in my Rocket Book. Right? So I got the little one right here. I got the full size one on the desk, right? It's something I use every day in my personal and professional life. It's been a tool that the last 2 years since I found it has, you know, from an efficiency standpoint, has changed the way I take notes, has changed the way my crappy handwriting can be digitized into, you know, typed Word documents for ease of use to send in emails and everything. So I would highly recommend, if you don't know what Rocketbook is, check them out, get one, use it for a few months. I guarantee it'll change your life. Welcome everybody to another episode, starting tonight with Josh Bonnatel, former strength coach, stops in the NBA, stops in the private sector, Mike Boyle, stops in the college space, stops in Wall Street Journal articles. I think one of the only collegiate strength coach who has a Wall Street Journal article with him in it. And currently, as a founding VP, and correct me if I'm wrong, Josh, I want to make sure I get it right. He was on the founding team as a vice president of operations and is now the vice president of performance for Future. And exactly what Future is, we're going to get into and everything. But Josh, as we were talking about before we started recording, the key thing to this is getting future coaches to understand how not only to be a great coach, but to develop financial freedom outside of just coaching, learning business, understanding, you know, financial savvy, whether that's learning how to do your own banking, whether that's understanding how to do your own taxes, whatever it is around business, right? And what business means to you. So first question, when did you decide to say, I'm hanging up my coaching hat and I'm going somewhere else?
You know, I think that's kind of a loaded question, honestly. You know, for me, it was just, it's kind of the continual journey in the process of sort of never being satisfied and always reaching and wanting something more. And I think, you know, early on, you know, it starts probably the same way, you know, as a lot of coaches in the industry is, you know, I had a passion for basketball. I grew up, I was a diehard basketball fan. You know, my entire life revolved around it. I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, hour and a half north of Chicago, during the dynasty, during the Jordan years. And so, you know, everything I did revolved around playing basketball, watching basketball. And you couldn't tell me any different. Like from an early age, I was not just going to play in the NBA, but, you know, I was going to play for the Bulls. And I was one of those kids that, like, I never really let that dream die as much as, you know, like all my friends are clowning on me. And quite frankly, you know, I wasn't that good of a basketball player. Like I didn't even play college, you know, but yet I clung on to that dream. Fortunately for me, I had enough sense to go, you know, okay, well, you know, hypothetically, let's say I don't play for the Bulls, like, you know, on the off chance it doesn't happen, I should have a backup plan. And, you know, I think the process of, you know, putting in the time and the work and developing to become a better athlete, become a better player, I fell in love with that. And so it led me down the path, obviously, to become a coach in the first place, which for me, and this is sort of getting to what ultimately led me to future, was, you know, knowing what I wanted to do at a really early age, I think like late high school, early college, I was already, you know, I sort of set a goal for myself that by the time I'm 35, not just I'll be ahead NBA or high major Division I college basketball strength coach, but really it was like by the time I'm 35, I'll be able to get that job anywhere. And so, like, in particular, you know, for me it was a dream, the Bulls. And so then now it's like, how do I get there? And so what I did was I really studied and I kind of learned about the journeys of people who were already in those positions that I wanted to one day get to. And I studied, you know, the commonalities, where had they been, places I'd never heard of, mentors at the time I'd never heard of. I looked those people up. I reached out to them. I tried to, you know, find out more and sort of follow that path. So kind of skipping ahead, through that process throughout college, I was able to put myself in a position where the very first opportunity I had when I graduated college was to go and intern with the Chicago Bulls. And kind of funny full circle moment for me was in third grade, I had a teacher who gave us this assignment, you know, write a letter to your future self 15 years from now, where will you be? And somehow I have no idea how this teacher did it. She got that letter in the mail. So 15 years later, I'm living at home. I'm commuting, you know, down to the Berto Center where the Bulls train. And I get this letter and it literally is just one line. I will be the starting point guard for the Chicago Bulls. And so for me, that was just kind of like, A, it was a full circle moment. You know, I wasn't obviously playing for the Bulls, but I found another way to kind of make that dream happen. And even then, you know, and fast forward a year later is when I got hired full time as the assistant. So now I'm 24 going on 25. I'm the assistant strength coach for the Bulls. And quite frankly, that's my dream job. And so that was the first time for me when, you know, I really thought about it. I'm like, man, I set this goal of 35. And for me, I've already hit it. I'm 24. Like, this is more than, you know, what I said.
Hey, shout out to that teacher for making that happen. That's an amazing.
It's insane, that, right?
Lady, man, whoever it was.
Yeah.
Kudos to you for, again, like investing in your kid, like investing, yeah, in your students.
Exactly.
That you followed that.
Exactly.
15 years later. That's amazing.
Exactly. No, it's incredible, man. And it's just, you know, the power of, you know, just really not being afraid, like no dream is too big, you know, and both believing in yourself and having people who believe in you along the way. But yeah, I mean, for me, I think that was kind of one of the first moments where I'm like, man, I set the bar too low. And so even at that stage, I'm 24, 25. I started thinking, I'm like, man, it's something bigger than being a head NBA strength coach. And that led me down this path of, I want to be a high performance director. And at that time, you didn't see that at all in the U.S. You saw it, you know, Dave Tenney was starting to do it a little with Seattle, but really you saw it in Australia and Europe with, you know, AFL teams, Premier League soccer and all that. And so I sort of thought like that was the new thing. And then fast forward when I'm 27 is when Mike Boyle actually is who recommended me for the Purdue job. So that's how I ended up there. So now I'm 27. I take over as the director of, you know, for Purdue men's basketball. And it was really a fortuitous opportunity for me because they never really had a, surprisingly, they never put much of an investment in the sports performance strength and conditioning program until I got there. So it was really a blank slate to kind of build something from the ground up. And because of that, because of the autonomy that my head coach gave me, and probably quite frankly, because I also like sort of operated under a, you know, I'm going to do what I believe is best for our guys, whether anybody else agrees with me or not, because at the end of the day, I think this is what's going to get us results. And, if anybody doesn't agree with it, they can fire me and I'll be okay. Like I'll dust myself off. I'll be fine. And so kind of those two things together and taking that approach, it really kind of allowed me to scratch that itch of the, you know, I guess I wasn't like officially a high performance director, but, you know, we were among one of the first teams in all of basketball, NBA included, to have GPS, to be doing sports science, you know, and incorporating some of that and a lot of the different things that we were doing. And so, you know, I think I realized, especially my last two or three years at Purdue, because we had really put a lot of time into developing and building our culture. And one of the big things that we did was we built a player-led culture. And that's around the time you and I first connected. In fact, you came through and you probably thought I was an idiot because guys were just working out and I was off talking to you.
That's how I did it. I always said, by the end of the year, if my guys needed me still, I failed. Because I didn't teach them anything. If they're always looking to you, what do I do?
Yeah.
There's no autonomy. There's no self-development. Like
exactly.
And I know Matt, I'll speak for Matt because I've known him so long and I know his style. It's not about making you lift more weight. It was about making you a better person through the use of physical training, which gave you skills to take into life.
That's exactly right. Yeah, no, and that was – you know, the approach that we always had was, you know, every single one of our players inside of 1 year, inside of their first year, they should be able to be, you know, my assistant strength coach, essentially. And they really, you know, embody, like they owned that. And so my last 2 to 3 years there, if I did anything for our guys, I probably got in the way. Like, quite honestly, if I wasn't there, we probably would have had more success. Cause it ran itself. Like those guys, you know, they kind of ran the show and, you know, so it was really comfortable. I didn't have to think, I could just show up and we were running a high level program. Thanks to our guys and just the culture we built. But like, for me, that was just, it wasn't enough, you know? And, I think around that time, around my, you know, last year, second to last year, I had a few different mentors who started to get me to think bigger. I think, you know, when you're young, you think 5 years out. It's always 5 years out, 5 years out. Well, 5 years out is really limiting. And for the first time, I thought 15 years out, 20 years out, because I had a mentor, one of our biggest donors who, you know, I don't know that he's quite a billionaire, but like up there through pharmaceuticals. If the Dosa Keys, like most interesting man in the world, existed in real life, it was him. It was this dude. He's, you know, 80 years old and just an amazing guy, wealth of knowledge. And the thing he said to me, he was like, Josh, your career doesn't actually begin until you're 35. And that was a really powerful statement for me because I think I was you know, I was 34 at the time when he told me that. And now I'm 15 years in building my career. And to think about like, man, I haven't even started my career. I haven't even begun to dive down the path of the most impressive thing that I'll accomplish.
So what I'm hearing consistently, and I love your messaging and what you're saying. So I just really want to get clarification on this. You talk about goal setting, and I think it's one of the biggest things young strength coaches do poorly is they have that goal, right? My goal was working in the NFL. I did it my first job out of freaking grad school. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Exactly. So it leads to some things where you almost feel unfulfilled at that point. And I was there for a very short time, so some part of me wants to go back and do that.
Right.
But that being said, you still have other goals you develop over time. So
I guess
my question is kind of, when you do your goal setting and you go through it, and how do you do that for yourself? And how do you adjust when things get setbacks or goals change and you kind of reorient yourself? What does that look like for you as far as your goal setting?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I wish I had a better answer of like, cause all the stuff I know I should do, like that I tell like people that I try and mentor and help, like, I'm like, you know, write this down and write out, you know, and so I'm always like, and I'm going to do it. But for whatever reason, it just ends up like up here in my head. The thing I do, I read all the time. I journal all the time. And so a lot of times I reflect back on those journal entries from previous years. And it's just interesting to see over time how your path starts to shape in that way when you write it down and you speak it into existence.
I'm sitting up
amazing.
In my office in my attic.
Amazing.
Right? I got an office upstairs. I got my 2020 current.
I love it.
I got all the old ones, but no, I hear you, man. There's something to it.
Yeah. I think, you know, the big thing, and it took me a little while to learn this. And in fact, I think it was driven home the most by one of the athletes I coached at Purdue, David Bedaya, who he was a gold medalist in 2012 platform diver in the London Olympics. And, you know, I learned a lot from his journey is, you know, it has to be about the journey. It can't be about, you know, that destination. And he really spoke to that with me of like, you know, he made his first Olympics in 2008. And, you know, for him, his whole life was defined by that. It was get to the Olympics, win gold. And so now he makes it, he's a teenager, he makes it. And, he doesn't even make it through qualifying. So he doesn't, you know, no medal, no nothing. And he honestly went into a deep depression for about a year. And then finally, you know, and obviously he had great people in his corner, but he figured it out that it's so much bigger than that goal. You know, it's the journey and it's having, you know, something bigger that kind of, you know, pushes you because like you said, Matt, like you're never going to be satisfied. Like when you get there, then you're going to kind of look around and be like, oh, like this is it. I mean, it like, it's cool, but like sort of, you know, what's next. And so I think for me, it's just like constantly reflecting, reevaluating, having a really strong, circle of people to seek out and seek counsel and, you know, help guide me along that path. And, you know, I think the thing that happened for me when I looked longer term, 15 years, 20 years, is it led me to realize what's possible is, you know, 15 years from now, like I know nothing about brain surgery, but 15 years from now, I could be a brain surgeon. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not that complicated. There's a very clear path. You just got to go do it. Like show up, put in the work. It's a lot of time, you can figure it out. You know what I mean? And when I started thinking about that in that light, it was like, well, in 15 years, why couldn't I be the general manager or team president of an NBA team? Like, why couldn't I like architect the entire thing? Like I'll hire the head coach, I'll hire all the key positions, I'll, you know, draft in our talent, you know, all of that stuff, build the culture. Why couldn't I do it? But then it's like,
well, how did you reevaluate? So you're going through all these different things and you're picking different ones and you're looking at that bigger picture. When you went in and evaluated your life, right, to lead you to future, what you're building right now, and obviously we'll get more into the amazing success y'all have had, What did you do to reevaluate to realize this was your path for you?
Man, I don't know. I mean, again, I think it's just kind of that process of surrounding myself. Like I feel like every single person I surround myself with, like my close circle that, you know, are like group text thread and people that I call or they call me on a regular basis is all people that I look up to and admire that are like doing things way bigger than me. So I think just surrounding myself kind of with excellence is like pushes me to continue to like be like, man, I got to step my game up, you know, because I see everything that they're doing. I read all the time, you know, like I live a pretty boring life because when I have free time, I just read, you know, I don't do anything crazy. I read, I journal all the time. And so I think it's just through having those moments, like constantly learning, growing, reflecting, you know, where I'm just kind of like constantly evaluating, like, what are some of the skills that I'm developing? What are the things that, you know, are kind of quote unquote my superpowers, you know, or can become, and what are the things I'm really passionate about? Like, what do I love doing? And I think over time, as you have a lot of different experiences throughout your early career, hopefully what you're doing is you're sampling, you're exposing yourself to a lot of different people, a lot of different experiences, and all of those things. And through that sampling, I think you can start to dial into, you know, what are the things that A, I'm really, really good at, and B, that I love to do. You know, because those things don't always line up. You could love something and suck at it, or be great at something and hate it. Like, you know, that I think happens all the time. But for me, I think the thing that really triggered me then too was like looking at that. Again, I did the same thing as I did when I was younger. I looked to who are the really successful GMs that I admire, and how did they get there? So I looked at, like, in particular, Bob Myers was one, but then the biggest one that was a motivator for me was Theo Epstein. And Theo Epstein's probably on the Mount Rushmore of, you know, executives in sport. Like, I'm a diehard Cubs fan, so I'm biased, but I mean, he broke, you know, probably the two biggest curses in all of sport. And
Boston,
he did it differently.
I've been at the parades. I'm from Boston.
Yeah, exactly.
We need to move on from baseball. I'm a Yankees fan. Let's just go.
Hey, right.
So, you guys
the last 10 years didn't happen.
I know. Actually, here, right? So, Josh, you're dropping so much. And this is what we have. We have such good people that me and Matt just let it flow, right? Because in the last 2 minutes, you've dropped 15 things. I'm taking my notes, right, as always. So you talk about developing people and culture. You talk about different mentors. So let's – I got a couple questions, and I know Matt's okay. going to jump in with me too. The one thing that I think – and we actually had a conversation with Dr. Megan Sullivan, who's a mental performance sports psychologist – and okay. She talked about goal setting. It was exactly the story you told with your swimmer, your diver, sorry.
Yep.
When you define yourself to an outcome and that doesn't happen, you get there but don't.
Yeah.
So I think one of the biggest things, and something I do, showing you the journals, I know Matt does, defining yourself, having goals and setting goals, but also reevaluating, reverse engineering how, you know, you sat there and said, okay, why can't I do this? Let me find the path. Let me reverse engineer.
Right.
So, right, there's so many things in here, right? Even the question I have for you is, from what I understand, is your time at Purdue, it started to slow down, right? I describe it to people as the first time you go in, it's warp speed, right? You're going 1,000 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to start to slow down. You're going to get more comfortable and you can get complacent. It can slow down because you're just in the zone complacently going through.
Right.
Or it can slow down because you've crafted it that way. So now you can take energy and use it somewhere else. I want you to talk about your different mentors and how, when it slowed down at Purdue, you talk to these mentors, right? So who, who are they? What did they give you for advice in addition to the one, you know, person you mentioned? But then what did you actually do to move down this new path? Did you you mentioned you read. Did you start reading new books, right? In strength, you see everyone, they start reading technical. Then all of a sudden, leadership. Then all of a sudden, they read business and management.
Right.
Their evolution of their career.
Yeah.
I fortunately had mentors who said, read the management and leadership shit first. Learn the technical skills.
Yeah.
Work with people, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So that's, how did you go from it slowed down, you were able to put time into something else, and then what exactly did you do to get, and how did you get to future?
Yeah. So, you know, I think, and to your point, man, I don't know if I read a book on training since college. You know, and you know, to be clear, it was like to your point of mentors, I just went out and spent my time with like who are the best in the world at every aspect of performance, and I'm gonna spend time there. So like, you know, I spent time at the Australian Institute of Sport with, you know, Julian Jones and Jeremy Shepherd, who's like one of the top strength and power physiologist probably on this planet. You know, I spent time with Cal Dietz probably 15 years ago, like before he ever released, you know, triphasic and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, right. Let me just give you one quick one. The last time I was in Minnesota, I flew in the morning.
Yep.
And I had to fly out that night to go to Kansas to go to KU for a meeting.
Okay. Yeah.
About 5 hours. I had about 45 minutes. Getting to Minnesota, the weight room, the campus.
Oh yeah, and
Cal. I had 3 hours, me and Cal in a boardroom. When I walked out, I took a picture of the board.
Yep.
Just because, and then I literally ate a burger with the guy, and then got on a plane. But talk about surrounding yourself.
Yeah. Oh, mad scientist. Yeah, I mean it's absolutely insane, and you know, and he's someone who. He probably doesn't even realize how much he shaped my philosophy, just the way he got me to think about things and challenge just conventional approaches. But, you know, being around him, obviously, you know, probably my two biggest influences from my time with Chicago is Al Vermeil, who, you know, I mean, just absolute legend and so gracious with his time, like was willing to just pour into me as like a young idiot coach, you know, trying to find his way. And Eric Helland, who was my boss, you know, and mentor with the Bulls as well. Obviously, you mentioned Mike Boyle, I worked with for about a year. At that same time, Eric Cressy had just opened up his first ever gym inside of like these batting cages. And so Eric Cressy was, you know, is one of my really close friends and someone that I spent countless hours with that year as he was like just starting to make his way. But anyway, you know, like
future,
just constantly
guest on the show, by the way, we're the UConn connection.
I love it. Yeah.
So.
Oh, he's just Eric's amazing. But so, you know, I think that's always how I learned, you know, in terms of the X's and O's and the technical aspects of coaching. And so, you know, I think even back when I was with the Bulls, everything that I was reading, and really it probably stemmed from Al and E, was, you know, it was leadership and it was psychology. And it was, you know, because I learned that if you don't understand people and you can't build relationships, like none of it matters. Like, I don't care what program you put together. If you don't have a relationship with you know, whoever it is in front of you that you're working with, it's meaningless. And so that's kind of the rabbit hole I always went down. And then to your point of, you know, everything slowing down, and that's kind of what it was. You know, I was 27 when I took over at Purdue. And so obviously it was really hard at first, you know, because you're building something that had never existed before. And I mean, like, I looked younger than every single one of my guys, quite honestly. So it was really hard at first. By year three, year four, we're kind of rolling. It's starting to, you know, run itself. And then to your point of being complacent, what I did was I just started manufacturing challenges, like things that were working well. I just broke them on purpose to see, like, could we do it better? and it created like more work and more challenge, you know, which led down that path of player-led culture. But then, you know, to what ultimately led me to Future was when I looked at Theo and how he had gotten to where he is today, Theo's journey is really pretty non-remarkable. You know, Theo is a guy who literally, you know, he was very opportunistic. You know, he did have a few relationships or introductions early on in his career. And he took advantage of those and he turned them into opportunities and he worked his freaking tail off. But the thing he did when he was around 25 or 26, he was an operations assistant with the Padres organization and he started going to law school at night. So he was going to law school at night, working for the Padres during the day. You know, he gets his JD, I think when he was maybe 28, 29 is when the Red Sox bring him on, rest is history. And so it's late September, my last year at Purdue, what ended up being my last year at Purdue. And I kind of knew it was going to be my last year because we had a group of four seniors. And so the year before, I was like, I'm giving it one more year because I'm going to go out with them because they were a special group. And I just looked at what Theo had done. And I was like, if I'm going to be a GM or team president, there's nothing today and there's no reason why I couldn't go and do that. But the challenge that I think I may face is I have the relationships and I can get in the right rooms. My concern is when I'm talking to a team owner, do they look at me and they go, who scheduled this meeting with the strength coach? Like, why am I, you know, and they value the weight of my words less. And so I just thought, you know, I think I need to rebrand myself and I need to do something that when I walk into a room, people immediately take notice. And even I might be saying the exact same thing, but there's something that just gives a little bit more weight to it. And so it's late September. I kind of look it up and I figure out that basically if I don't take the LSAT December 2nd, it's kind of too late to start law school the following year in the fall. And so again, having a really broad circle, I have several very close friends who've gone that route. So I reached out to them. I'm like, you know, is this crazy? Like, is 2 months, you know, is that enough time to study for that? And they're like, absolutely not. Like most people spend 6 months to a year. And I'm like, well, 2 months it is. Like,
let's go.
The only way. Yeah. And so, you know, my thing was that day I went to Barnes and Noble. I bought a LSAT like prep book. Cause I'm like, you know what? That costs $50. If I don't take the test, I'm out $50. Big deal. Then the deadline to register was like a week or two later. That's another $250, $300. So I'm like, well, if I don't register, I can't take the test. So worst case, I'm out $300 now. But now I'm in. Like, I'm taking it regardless. And it's still like, I might not go to law school, but I have to take it to be able to apply. I have to, you know, and so on. So I'm like literally hiding because we're in season. I'm hiding out in hotels, like in back hallways, studying for the LSAT, because if one of my players or our coaches walks up on me, like, how am I going to explain? Like, I'm reading logic games for fun, you know? And so I take, you know, I fast forward, I take the LSAT in December. I, you know, apply all these schools. It's late January. I end up getting accepted to 7 different law schools. And what I thought I was doing was, I'm going to law school and I had it worked out where whatever city I ended up, you know, accepting and going, I had it lined up where I was going to be able to work in the front office for that NBA team in some capacity, just through my relationships. And with a couple of the cities, I had optionality to work on the other side of the table with an agency. So I'm getting all set up to do this. And all of a sudden I get an email out of nowhere and it's recruiting me for Future. And it was like, I still give our founding COO a hard time because he's the one that sent the email recruiting me. It was like the worst grammar ever. Everything was lowercase. And it just felt like one of those where it's like, okay, the next thing he's going to ask me for is like my bank account and my social security number. You know what I mean? And it was my Hotmail account, which
you're a royal family member and they owe you.
Yeah, exactly.
Like 10 grand, exactly. You get 5 million.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so I'm like, you know, I honestly, I kind of pushed it aside But then I was like, man, this does sound pretty like insane, because it was like, you know, our CEO is an astrophysicist by trade. He's like reported to Sergey at Google, ran product there, had his own company, was a VC himself. Our COO, although this didn't mean anything to me at the time, this is how naive I was the first ever employee at DoorDash and ran ops for DoorDash, like from the time they were in a garage to when they were worth several hundreds of millions of dollars. Today, they're, I don't even know, probably $20, $30 billion company at least. They might even be more. I haven't kept up recently. And then our CTO he's part of the original iPhone team. There were 20 people inside of Apple. It was a top secret team, 20 people, including Steve Jobs. He was one of them that built the first ever iPhone. And in fact, he built FaceTime and iMessage himself, the first iteration. And then it was his teams that kind of, you know, built that out. So more or less, that's what this email says. It's like, here's our team. We're doing something really cool to change the world. You should come do this with us and kind of be that fourth pillar. And so I'm skeptical. And I pass it on to, again, just relationships, man. Like during my time in Chicago, I made several really key relationships with really good friends who are all incredibly successful in the tech and startup world and VC world and all of that. So I ran it by them because they're all naturally skeptical anyways. So I'm totally expecting them to be like, dude, you're an idiot. Like, this is not real. This is fake. And every single one of them was like, this sounds like it could be amazing. Like, you have to follow up on this. And so I did. It was funny. You and I did a podcast. It was a Sunday. And I hit the guy back because he wanted to talk that day. It was our founding COO. And I was like, hey, I can't talk today. I can talk tomorrow. But I'm going to be on this podcast later. Like, tune in and if you want. He actually did, by the way.
Shout out. It was me, Josh.
Yeah.
And Matt knows Chris because Chris was an undergrad with me.
That's right. Yeah.
So again, the six degrees of separation. There you go.
That's crazy. Yeah, exactly. So that led to this process, you know, probably 2 or 3 month process, getting to know my co-founders, getting to know the opportunity and the vision. And, you know, also having such a strong decision-making circle. So my decision-making circle, and there were several people, but among the key ones, one of them was my good friend from college who actually teaches a course on startups at NYU, and he advises executives who join startups. Not to mention, he's an executive himself with a company called Frog, which is a crazy design firm. The other one was, you know, the show Billions?
Mm-hmm.
At the time, he was he worked for the hedge fund that Billions is based on, reporting directly to the person that Bobby Axelrod's character is based on.
Yeah.
And he was getting ready to leave that to start his own $50 million crypto fund. So that was another one I had in my corner. And the third one was a really good friend from Chicago who'd started his career in finance, realized that there's so much opportunity in like fintech and startups in San Francisco. He was like, I just need to get to San Francisco and there's no way I can't be successful. So he dropped everything, moved to San Francisco without a job, lied on his resume because there's no way he could have got any of these jobs because he didn't have the technical skills. But he was like, I'll figure it out. But if I don't, you know, have it, they won't hire me. And now he's basically being groomed to ultimately be the CFO of this crazy crypto fund company, whatever. So these are like three of the people advising me. You know, the power in that was like, I didn't know this world at all. I didn't know the opportunity. Like one of the questions I was asking them, I was like, so how does this work? Like, are they just going to give me, you know, a big percentage stake in the company, but I work for free and like either makes money or it does, like basically either I'm a millionaire or I'm broke. And they all looked at me and they're like, dude, if they tried not to pay you, like, no, absolutely not. You know, but like, that's how little I knew. And so through their guidance, through them walking me through the decision-making process, it allowed me to understand what was in front of me. And, you know, one of the things I realized was like, even setting that goal of being a GM, I set the bar way too low, because it was like, this is something I could have actually never envisioned at the time. And this was an opportunity that, like, when we're successful, we will have changed the world. We will have brought preventative healthcare to the world and impacted millions of people's lives. Like, this is the opportunity in front of us. Another thing they all told me, they were like, from a professional standpoint, every single one of them said this. They were like, 100% when it comes down to it, you know, because they were helping me through the negotiation, all that. They said, 100%, you have to do this. And they said, in saying that, you have to expect, not maybe, not it could, not possibly, 100% it will. In 1 year, it will fail. Either you don't raise your next round, you're flat out of money, the company doesn't exist, or just you hate it. You know, you're miserable. It sucks. Because they all told me, they're like, this is going to be the hardest job you ever have in your entire life. You're going to have the lowest moments of your entire life. You know, it's not all sunshines and red. Like, this is going to suck. Like, it's going to be really hard. But there's so much opportunity from that for growth and development. And they said, in 1 year, you'll grow 5 years professionally.
Before we get into that, how amazing you guys are doing now and kind of what you're dealing with in the current situation, here's a couple of things that I really want to drive home, and mm-hmm. you absolutely crushed during your conversation, was just how much you talked about being uncomfortable and that growth, right? We already talked about gold. Mm-hmm. You know what you're getting. And it's a perfect time, because you just talked about how this is going to be the most difficult part of your professional life and how much mm-hmm. you're going to grow, you know, that 5X, 10X, whatever that amount is. So just going back to that, what makes, and what would you recommend to young coaches or young people who want to create something bigger than strength and conditioning, athletic training, physical therapy, whatever they're working on? What allows them to be uncomfortable, or what do you recommend to them as far as not just goal setting, but how to get through that being uncomfortable?
You know, I was talking to Duncan Robinson, who just played in the, you know, he like started for the Heat in the NBA Finals. I was talking to him the other day, because, you know, if you don't know, I mean, his story is insane, you know, remarkable. He was a Division III college basketball player, ends up at, you know, National Player of the Year, Division III, makes it to Michigan, should have never made it there. Then he's undrafted. All of a sudden, you know, he's a two-way player. And then this year he's like starting, dropping 26 points in the finals for the Heat. And he said something to me. He was like, you know, I think people really overestimate what you can accomplish in one day, and they underestimate what you can accomplish over time by showing up each day. And it was really funny, because I said to him, I was like, man, that resonates with me, because something I always say is showing up is a skill. And it really is. I mean, it's crazy, because it's the simplest thing that you can do is just show up. But yet it's incredible how many people don't do that. They don't, you know, they face a little bit of adversity. It gets a little hard. And, you know, it's so easy to give into that. And to be fair, a lot of times, you know, especially, you know, the three of us all talking, we've each taken some really non-conventional paths. And along the way, people who, you know, actually do have your best interests in mind, and they're very well-meaning, you know, some of your dreams and your aspirations and your vision, they might not understand, or it might be bigger than what they can see, and maybe they want to protect you or whatever it is. And so, you know, I think a lot of times when it gets hard, you know, other people who they may be well-meaning, they want to protect you. So they're like, you know, kind of, you know, I knew this was going to happen. It's, you know, it's okay. Like, we'll get you a job over here, or come on back, or, you know, and, you know, I think the thing, so like, you know, one of the things my wife and I always talk about, and that's what you got to have. You got to have like one of the things I always talk about, and it's really who I, you know, my circle is all people who I would say live this concept. Like, I, on social media, I always put this thing like, hashtag like color outside the lines, because it's rare. You know, most people, there's a path that you're supposed to follow, you know, or this is the way you do X, or these are the opportunities that exist, you know, and it's safe. And, you know, this is what you're supposed to do is color inside the lines. And the people I surround myself with are all people that don't do that. They buck conventional wisdom, and they've all failed. We all have. And so you need some of those people, hopefully, if you have who are ahead of you that you can look to, and they can, you know, and that's even, you know, what I have. We talked about my mentor from Purdue's in his 80s, you know, nearly a billionaire. And he would just laugh at times, and because he would tell me, you know, all of the failures before where like he could have and should have, and most people would have, you know, turned back. But the thing that I think got me through in particular with Future was before we ever made the decision, my wife and I, to like make that leap, the thing that we said to each other was like, no matter what, no matter how hard it gets, no matter like how low, you know, we ever get, no matter how much we question it, 1 year, like we have to, no matter what. So in going out there, it wasn't even a question. We had to go 1 year. And then at 1 year, like, then we could go and do something else. But without that 1 year, it's not enough to know, you know. And I think in a lot of, and it depends on the thing, but in a lot of cases, you can kind of figure out 1 year, you know. But it's a lot to kind of weather that. And you know, speaking specific to Future, I mean, there are a lot of nights, man. Like, I'll be honest, like, I broke down and cried, you know. Like I'm like, man, what did I do? Like, we're across the country from comfortable life in West Lafayette, the basketball team, we're rolling. We were number three in the country my last year. And quite honestly, you know, I've had several opportunities. Like I had probably in my first month, I had two like blank check offers to come back to college basketball. And even in my first month, it was my first day. I think I told Joe this story. Yeah. By noon of my first day, I was like, man, what did I do? And I could probably go call Coach Paint right now because I know he hasn't filled my position, and I could come right back. And then at the end of that week, I had a blank check offer to come back into college. And I think it was a week later, I had another one. And I'm like miserable at this point. I'm like, man, you know, I can, but it was like, no, it has to be 1 year, you know? And especially in this world, like there's, go ahead.
No. So you hit on, again, you're hitting on so many things, and we're both sitting here like not wanting to cut you off because you're just riding, right? That's part of our thing, is just let you flow. So you hit on a big thing. I forget. I know me and you have talked about it. I forget who said it. If someone knows, by all means, correct me. You live the 1 to 10 life. You don't live the 5, 6, 7, right? Everyone's a 5, 6, 7. It's safe. It's happy. They know they can. Mm-hmm. They know what's coming. Mm-hmm. I want a 10 or I want a 1. I don't want a 5, 6, 7. I actually said to my wife the other day, which is going to lead me to my question for you. You know, I was like, you know, I was up late the other night doing stuff. You know, we're managing family time, personal time to mm-hmm. do this today. You know, so I said to her earlier today, I was like, hey, see you on Friday. And she was like, what? I'm like, well, last night she went to bed early because she worked late and she was tired. Tonight I have this. Tomorrow she's on call. And then Friday we have a family thing and we're going out. And I was like, so I won't really spend time with her until Friday night. And she looked at me and she was like, yeah, I know. I was like, hey, I was like, to be extraordinary, you know, there's that balance.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah,
you know, is. Again, we try and be extraordinary, right? We don't want 5, 6, and 7. We want 10, but the cost is 1, right?
Right.
You don't
hit
a 10, you hit a 1. Mm-hmm. So family, right? We're talking all this. You're talking rebranding yourself. You're talking all these opportunities, possibly law school. You're talking all these things. And now you started getting into the commitment, showing up every day, putting the grind in, putting the work in. Mm-hmm. How do you balance, right? I remember talking to you and talking to Gavin, who took over for you. Like, you got married. So you're now in San Francisco. You committed to a year of doing it.
Yep.
You have your up and your downs. You just got married. What's your wife looking at, and how are you managing?
Oh, man. She hated me. my wife, man, just the, you know, she's a rock, you know, she, just the support and everything like that. But, you know, I think what it is, the thing I always talk about, and to your point, the one versus the 10, you know, to me, how I look at it and how I talk about it is like, you got to have a switch. So your switch is, a switch either goes on. If it's on, it's all the way on. And if it's off, it's all the way off. And it's not a dimmer. And I think the problem for a lot of people is, whether they know it or not, they have a dimmer. And I think that's where you hear this. It's a pet peeve of mine, quite honestly, when people talk about work-life balance, because what they are alluding to me is a fallacy. Like if you have work-life balance at all times, truly you're just mediocre at both things. You just are. You know what I mean? And so, you know, I think there are times and Ben Horowitz is notorious for kind of talking about this. He founded some, you know, internet companies way back, and now leads one of the biggest venture capital funds in Silicon Valley. He talks about this concept of like wartime CEO and peacetime CEO. And I've kind of extrapolated that to, you know, I think there are times for, you know, within your career as a whole, you know, I think if you have these big aspirations, like, you know, Matt and I were talking about, our dream was, you know, for him, NFL, me, NBA. And I think even to put yourself in position to do something like that, it's probably your 20s, where like literally it's all wartime. And like there probably isn't much of a concept of, you know, like life. It's just because, but the reason you're doing that is so that then when you're, you know, 35 or so, you can start to have some flexibility and freedom to live wherever you want to live, to be doing whatever you want to do, to be on your schedule, to be, you know, financially in a strong position, and to kind of be doing whatever you want to do, where like the second you're not happy with it, you can walk away from it. And that takes a lot. And so I think, you know, for me, that was my 20s, where it was like, anybody who is in my life right now, they got to realize that point blank, this comes first and everything else is second and then some. And that's just how it is, like my entire 20. And to be clear, that's not for everyone, and it doesn't need to be. You know, everyone has their own, you know, whatever makes you happy is the most important thing. And that's it. For me, for you, us talking right now, it's how, and for me, it's not even the like, you know, being the best or the excellence or changing, you know, this concept of like changing the world. For me, it's how can I continue to grow my platform so that I can elevate others? I think you said it right before we got on, was like, you know, the rising tide, you know, or whatever, rising tide.
No, tide lifts all boats.
Yeah, exactly. And that's always what it's been about for me. I think that's, you know, when people talk about like, what's your why? I think that's the thing that's always been hard for me to like define, like, what do you want to do? Cause I'm like, I don't really know what I want to do, but I know why I want to do it. I want to do it. Like, I want to grow this platform because I've been so fortunate to surround myself with such amazing people, not just inside the sports world, the business world, entertainment, all these different things. Like, I want to go somewhere where I can, like, they have ambitions and dreams and I want to help them get there. And I want to challenge them that their dream is too small to come up with, you know, something bigger than that. And, you know, so anyways, that's what has always motivated me. Now, as I get later in my career, you find your spots in what you're doing where like it's wartime. And I think that's where I, you know, and it's always a work in progress, but I try to work on this of like really communicating this with my, similar to you. You're like, I'll see you on Wednesday, and you're laughing about it, but it's a real thing. If you communicate that and you say, I'll see you on Wednesday because this stuff's got to get done and, you know, yada, yada, then cool. Like it's, you know, it's, you have that relationship. There's an understanding. But then on that day, then it's like the switch for work is off. Your phone is like
Friday at 5 o'clock. We're doing a little trick or treat scavenger hunt thing.
Nice.
Saturday, we're doing stuff with family. Sunday, it's off.
I love it.
Friday at 5 till Monday at 8 when I walk into the office, it's off. Because I had to do this.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The ability to turn it off does not come into concept when you're that early to mid 20 strength coach. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You're, you know, building Purdue basketball, you're building you're building Kansas, you're building wherever the heck else you are, and you're taking it and making that area the best you possibly can. And like you said, making stuff just to rebuild it better is extremely important for your development. Would Purdue basketball have been just as good if you kept with a similar system? Probably. But it was good for to go through that and to learn that. And all our institutions, I know Joe and I were, you know, head strength coaches at FCS schools before working at other bigger places and after working at bigger places, having to build that from such a small piece at a young age, coach job by our mid 20s, that is a huge learning curve that you need to
learn.
How many times did you talk to an AD when you were the assistant? Maybe like hello at a party. When you walked into the weight room for the first time all semester and just wanted to make sure.
So
the idea of going in and talking to a sport coach on a peer level at every, you know, sport, whether it's the most income or the least income, doesn't matter anymore. You have to be able to work with all of them. So I guess the point is that being able to turn on that switch. Like tonight, same thing. When I was doing my RD program, same thing. I would literally go to bed. Excuse me. I would put my kid to bed, wake up with her 3 hours later after doing my exam. Whatever, put her one more bottle, put her to bed. Then I finally go to 8 a.m., wake up at 6 a.m., go to full-time work, you know, or 5 a.m. Work for 6, 6:30. Switching off, man. I mean, that switch was on for 3 years, but it led
I wanted.
Now I got licensure, and we'll see where it takes me.
But yeah, that's amazing.
Thinking back to that Theo freaking example, that Epstein example, like that JD at night. I hate the Red Sox. I love the Cubs. You know, they're cool. Whatever. But it's cool to see somebody else to go through that. So using that, I want to ask you this question. What do you think is the next big thing you want to work on after future?
Yeah, so, you know, I was just having this conversation with a few people and actually like one of our investors who's become a big mentor of mine. And just looking at, you know, what's really interesting is, and Joe and I talk about this a lot, is you look at the space right now with health and fitness technologies and especially too right now because of the pandemic. It's insane. Like Whoop today just raised another $100 million, $110 million. They're a $1.2 billion company today. Peloton, you know what's crazy? If you spend like 3 or 4 days without looking at Peloton's market cap, the next time you look at it, it's $5 billion more than it was. So this might be wrong, but like 10 days ago, it was $39 billion. So it's probably like 46 now. And at the start of all this, they were, you know, maybe 10 to 12. And so you have all these companies like that Tonal, Oura Ring, The Mirror, all these different things. And right now, what's interesting is when you look at, you know, investment and venture capital dollars, health and fitness technologies is probably the number two space where all of that money is going and could even become the number one space. And so even for as big as it is today, it's only going to become exponentially larger. And so what's interesting for me is, you know, now in taking the leap, now it's been 2.5 years, little over actually. And, you know, we went from being a seed stage company to, you know, 8, 9 months later, raising our Series A to now, you know, a little over a year after that, raising another $24 million Series B. And so now what that does for me and kind of my marketability inside of the space and, you know, everything I've learned, like in 2.5 years, I've probably grown 10 plus years professionally. And so one of the things that's really interesting is, you know, that probably I would have never thought of as a strength coach is, like, I think there's probably an opportunity for me to get involved with more companies. You know, I think for right now, I'm where I need to be. And I know that because it's always just getting harder, which means I'm constantly leveling up. And I think, you know, I really credit my CEO, who's been an incredible mentor to me, because he never lets me get comfortable. The second I start to feel like, man, I'm pretty good at this thing, then right away, just like, wham, like knocks me on my ass. And I was like, okay, yeah, like I'm failing all over again and this sucks, you know, this is miserable. And so that's continuing to happen. We have a massive opportunity, you know, right now, even over the next few years. But, you know, I think longer term, I'd love to get involved with helping multiple companies and investing in several companies. So, you know, getting involved as a venture capitalist is something I've given thought to. You know, another thing, and again, credit to especially my CEO and our founding COO who recruited me, because they even said this to me in recruiting me. They were like, at the end of the day, you know, when it kind of came down to decision time, they were like, look, just even if, like, come do this with us for a year, you know, or 2 years, and then like help us build this, help us get it off the ground, and then go start your own company, because now you'll be able to, because they're like, everything that you'll have learned and the exposure and the relationships that you're able to build with really high level VCs and investors, they and this was the thing they told me. They're like, in this world, VCs, you know, yeah, they invest in, you know, ideas and products, but bigger than that, they invest in people. And so you spend a year, 2 years building this with us, it doesn't matter what your idea is, they're going to invest in it because they believe in you. And really powerful, like I've had some investors tell me that. They're like, Josh, if you ever go start a company, like one of our investors in particular told me, they're like, if you ever start a company, I don't care what your idea is, you don't even have to tell me. I'm writing the first check because I know it's going to be successful, you know? And so I think that's something that, you know, really inspires me that I'd love to do, because that's also a way of, like, you know, I think for me, it's always about not what I'm doing, but who I'm working with. And, you know, kind of this circle of just amazing people in my life that I'm very close with that are all doing crazy things. I've always been searching for a way of, like, how can we ultimately, like, all come together and build, you know, something together. And then the third thing, because, you know, I think that itch will never go away, is like the GM team president thing. But now I'm thinking about it in even a different light. And, you know, even like a couple of our investors have put this in me too. They're like, if you want to go and do that, like it's there for you. But they're like, the way sport is going now, you know, teams are being bought for several billion dollars. So it's not individual owners anymore, it's groups. And so there's an opportunity to be a part of one of those groups and help them navigate the decision, help them figure out who to hire as the GM. And so, like, again, in the nature of, like, always kind of, you know, never being afraid to, like, dream too big and you know, I feel comfortable now, like, putting it out there too, and people will probably laugh at me, tell me I'm crazy, like, whatever, like, that's all good. I'm content, because I also believe in the power of speaking it into existence, which is a fine line, because sometimes people say it and then they stop working because now they've said it. So it, and there's a psychological thing to that of, like, now you've said it, so you feel like it's done. Go ahead.
Exactly. No. So this is, it actually leads into exactly where I wanted to add a point to you, is you hit so many things right there. And I think the big one is, especially for young people in their career, you have to know when you have the hot hand, but when to play it or not, right? Like, I left Kansas. Everyone's like, why'd you leave Kansas? You just won a national title. You were finalist for assistant strength coach of the year. You just got a big bonus, like all this stuff. You just got this new equipment. I had the leverage because I was the hot hand to take that somewhere else, because what they didn't know was I was leaving anyways. I was getting married. I was toast.
Yeah, yeah.
So I leveraged my hot hand. But you also have to know when to not take the greener grass, in a sense, and when to. So one of my mentors, and he always called it Telsi. It sounds like Telsi, like a name, or, you know, it's T-E-L-C.
And okay.
Timing, effort, luck. So a lot of life is timing. A lot of it's the effort you put in, and some of it's luck. But the biggest thing of all is consistency. So it was timing, effort, luck, consistency. And if you had the right timing, and you, and again, you can only play, to use your points, you can only play the hot hand, you can only do stuff if you put the work in. If you just got there and then just sat on your ass and said, hey, I made it, you know?
Like, yeah,
it's going to get you so far before it craps out. So I again, I heard what you just said as a reinforcement to that. It's timing, it's effort, it's luck, and it's the consistency, because now, like you said, these investors, in that example, they know you can work hard. They know you can turn, you know, lemons into lemonade when you get lemons.
Right.
They turn orange juice into orange juice when you get oranges instead of lemons. And they like you. So now, why wouldn't I give you money?
Right, right. Exactly.
That's it. I didn't really have a question. It was just a point. Okay.
No, I love it. Yeah, man, you know, and I think that's, you know, even in my coaching career, it was something I had to learn while I was at Purdue. First of all, I never wanted to go to Purdue at the time. I was, you know, I was,
come on, don't
when
hang
I,
on.
When I left, there. Hey, when I left, I was 27. Derrick Rose had just won MVP. We had the best record in the NBA. And Chicago is a city where when you win, that entire city shows you love. I didn't pay for anything. You know, you eat at all the best restaurants. It's on the house. You, you know, everywhere you go. I mean, they take care of you. I'm 27. I'm living downtown Chicago. I remember even like pulling up on my interview and you're like, this is it. Like, it's the cornfields.
I interned with the Bears at that same time. The year, the year after they went to the Super Bowl. So, Yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to argue any of that.
Yeah. So it was, you know, I think that was an interesting journey for me because, quite honestly, I would not have even taken that interview. I only did out of respect for Mike Boyle, who recommended me, and for Eric, you know, my mentor with the Bulls, who said, like, you have to do this. And even when I got offered, I remember calling E and being like, E, you know, it just, it doesn't feel right, you know, because, but truly, like, I didn't want to leave Chicago. It was, I mean, it was fun. It was comfortable. It was, I was living out my dream in a lot of ways. But at the same time, I had outgrown that. I wasn't getting any better. And fortunately for me, he saw that. And so he pushed me, you know, he pushed me basically like, you don't have a choice, like, you're going. And, you know, I remember even my first 2 to 3 years was really hard. It was tough. And thankfully I had, you know, some amazing people working with me, helping me build the program. Nicodemus Christopher, my first year, Gary Christopher, my second year, and then Gavin, who ultimately ended up taking over for me. But in that time, I had several offers. I had opportunities to go to the NBA, to go to other college teams. And I was so close so many times because, to your point, Joe, you sort of think like, ah, like the grass is greener, or like they're going to pay a little bit more money. And I remember Eric said it to me. It was about my, you know, maybe my fourth year. And he was like, you haven't done anything yet. Like, you will, the professional capital that you can build by staying here and truly building something, like truly building something, is going to be way more valuable than if you go, like, if you go take, you know, even $50,000 more, $60,000, like, whatever, which, you know, some of these places would have been at least that much more. He was like, then you're just starting over again. So, like, you better love that place because you're going to be there at least the next, you know, 5 to 7 years. And it taught me to your point, and, like, riding the hot, but you got to build that hot hand first. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's what put me in the position ultimately to have the professional capital for Future to even reach out to me in the first place. And then when we talked, you know, for me to have the leverage to craft that opportunity in a way that, you know, made sense for me. And I think that's something that, again, when you talk about, you know, showing up and riding through that adversity in those tough times, I think you see it even in our profession where it's like, people will be at one place for a year or 2 years. They go somewhere else for a year and then, you know, and then they're somewhere new. And then all of a sudden, 10 years later, 12 years later, like they wonder why they're getting passed over by, you know, for some of these top jobs they're going for. And you're like, you've never built anything. You know, you don't have the professional capital and you have to, I do think you gotta at some point anchor somewhere and like build something.
Mm-hmm. No, 100%. You talked about rebranding yourself at one point in the conversation in terms of doing something mm-hmm. new. You got to brand yourself first. You have to stick yeah. your point. Like you actually have to be known as something before yeah. you open up to be something new.
Right.
I think that's one thing, especially in the industry for coaches, and we've all hit it and said it in conversations I've had with both of you, and I know you've had with other people, is it's the flavor of the week thing. It's I'm going to jump here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to jump there. I'm going to go this. And then all of a sudden, now I'm ready for the job. It's like, no, mm-hmm. you have a couple cups of coffee at a bunch of different places.
Right.
You have no idea how to make coffee yet.
Right. And right. Right. You know, right.
All right. So obviously we can just keep hammering this and out of respect for your time and our time. So we're going to start to bring it towards the end here. And we always have a couple questions like most podcasts and this kind of stuff. We always ask mm-hmm. a few of the same things of people because, however your conversation goes versus someone else versus someone else versus someone else,
yeah.
we can at least kind of come back to a couple core things, right? So our first one, I'll start and then Matt's going to nail a couple is,
and
we talked about this a little bit, but how do you sharpen your sword? Who teaches you? Who's your coach? And that can be right now today. And that can be, you know, the previous guest we had on talked about his dad, you know, he always called his dad, you know, so
yeah.
Who's your coach?
Well, you know, I think like, and I'll get to one, but I'm fortunate because I have such a strong circle. So I think one of the things I always talk about, and this is something that like I try to pass on this advice as well, is like there's, you know, strength in counsel. And so, you know, big decisions and, you know, things like that, I think it's really important and powerful to get a lot of different perspectives, you know, run it off a lot of different people and get everyone's take. And sometimes you're even coming back to an earlier person that you talked to with something the last person said. And, you know, ultimately then you got to make your own decision. So I think that's, you know, that's something that is, it's ongoing as you continue to build relationships. I will say, you know, just to give one person and also give an example of just like how crazy life is and the power of relationships. I would say right now, probably my number one most trusted advisor for navigating the world that I'm in, which to be clear is an entirely new world to me, you know, and I'm 2.5 years in, but I'm still like learning and seeing new things every single day, is you know, one of my closest friends that I consider a brother. His name is Sahil Bloom. Now, what's interesting about Sahil, how we first met was back when I was with Eric Cressy when he opened his first ever facility. Sahil was Eric's first ever baseball client, might even been his first ever client. Sahil's a junior in high school at the time when I met him. I just finished my internship with the Bulls. So I'm 23, you know, I'm probably whatever, 6-7 years older than him at the time. And quite honestly, like, you know, I would coach him a little, we would talk a little, but it wasn't like we kept in touch. It wasn't like we were super close. I think we might've been connected on social media somehow. And, but I always kind of knew what he was doing. And, you know, he was a really talented baseball player, went and played at Stanford, could have probably gone to the majors, but he's such a sharp dude, charismatic, all that. And so being out there, he ended up getting into venture capital right away. And now he's like a rising star in that world. When I ended up out there, we traded a couple like emails of like, let's catch up. And then it doesn't happen. Fast forward, we raise our Series A. And that was like a really opportunistic time of like, he reached out to congratulate me and was like, hey, let's catch up. Let's grab a coffee. And it was the craziest thing because in 2 minutes, it was like, this is someone who's been a brother of mine from the time I'm like 10 years old. You know, it was one of those relationships. And never, you know, when I was out there with Eric, he's a junior in high school. Like, never would you be like, man, I'm gonna kiss up to this dude because one day he could really, really help me.
You never know. I stress this more, especially to people in the Olympic sports. Your kids aren't going professional 99.9% of the time.
Right.
You know,
right.
If basketball and football, you got a chance depending on where you are.
Yeah.
I have more doctors, lawyers,
cheerleaders
from field hockey, crew, golf,
than I
ever did in basketball. And again, some of my basketball guys and girls, good kids, great careers in basketball or have done things. But I was per average. I mean, I have lawyers who were my athletes or my friends at UConn who I get free law advice. I have a contract lawyer from one of the biggest firms in New York City who's been a buddy of mine for 15 years. I call him and say, hey, give me this real quick.
That's amazing. Exactly.
$1,000 an hour advice.
Exactly. Every call I have with him, I'm like, man, like, there's executives who pay literally thousands of dollars to have this conversation right now. And he takes my call and he'll reschedule stuff. He takes my call. And this dude's like a contributor for CNBC now and like blowing. I mean, he's a stud. That's kind of my probably number one guy right now.
Cool. All right. I'm going to switch into my last question. I'm going to let Matt close it out with his and then actually wrap it all up. So we talked about managing time and finding balance and the asymmetry you need. Like I describe it as it's like the 10,000 hour rule. If you want to be good, you got to put in time. So you're asymmetric in life, but where you're at now, you're still asymmetric. And we talked about a little balance. How do you manage your time? You said you journal, do you use a bullet journal, a certain type of journal? Do you have a certain type of organization system? How do you manage your time to be able, like we said, light switch?
You know, I'll be honest, organization is probably my biggest weakness. I suck at it. I'm terrible. I hate like anything like I'm the person that, you know, you saw my office at Purdue. It's probably the messiest office you've ever walked into. But like that's what works for me.
It wasn't the most organized.
Not at all. My players have protein powder all over the table because they make their shakes in there. But anyways, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that I've had to adapt to in this world, especially with the nature of what I do now, is so much of my time is, you know, I'm on calls all day. I'm recruiting coaches to join our team. I'm talking to investors. You know, I'm trying to do different, you know, partnership deals and stuff like that. You and I talked about this not that long ago. One of the things I had to learn and learn quickly was like Google Calendar. And I felt like a sellout because I'm like, man, it is such a like kind of tool move to be like, I have such and such availability. Like, let's put it on a calendar.
If you're not on my calendar, I can't help you.
Yeah. No, and I still hate it.
It gets to that point.
But what I realized was, if it's on the calendar, it'll happen. It gets done. And if it's not, like, we'll just talk about it all the time and it'll never happen. So that's one, is like really using that calendar. I think that, in terms of the switch, that was a learning process for me. Year one was, and to be fair, I think, we were such a small team. There was so much work to be done and nowhere near enough people to do it. I had to, you're like, when I started, I literally, from the moment I woke up, I was working, I was responding to emails. I was, doing it from like 5:30 AM. The time I rolled out of bed, I was doing that until I'd be at our office until 11:30 at night. And then, my first 4 months, I was out there by my wife hadn't moved out there yet. So I was staying with a buddy. So 11:30, I knew the places that were still open that served food until about 1 AM. I'd go there, get some food, open my laptop because I still wasn't done, and be responding to emails and everything like that, get to bed at 1:30, do the same thing over, sleep deprived, and then just on the weekend, hopefully sleep without an alarm to catch up. And I think it was necessary at that time, but at the same time, what it probably took me a year to realize, because I think I also thought that, just building a program, it's going to be really hard at the beginning, but over time it's going to get easier. And that's not at all the case in this world. It never gets easier. It only ever gets harder. And the other thing that you learn is there's always more work to be done. You're never going to be done with the amount of things that need to get done. And I think that first year, I always thought like I have to work until I'm done. And then somebody finally said it to me where they're like, that work's going to be here tomorrow. And even if you finish it, there's still, more to do. So learning when to just I joke, I've done all I can do today. And quite honestly, I'll have some days here and there, cause you need it, where I'm like, I could take calls this afternoon, but my last call is going to finish at 1:30. And then I'm just going to go do my run. I'm going to read, I'm going to shut off. I'm not going to look at my emails. And then I might do some stuff later on at night. But what I realized, because, helping to found a company and get it off the ground, I'm getting all these emails at 3:30 in the morning from, my co-founders, largely for stuff that either I overlooked or I probably messed up or I failed at, or, and you're getting stressed. You're like, man, I'm going to get fired, all those things. And these things that you think oh man, I got to drop everything, or I got to drop my whole weekend now to solve this thing. And then, and somebody advised me on this, was like, when you leave the office, shut it all off, Slack, email, shut it all off. And so what I started doing was I would leave the office, I wouldn't look at any of that until the next day when I left my house. But it wasn't even until I left my house where I'd look at that. And a lot of times I'd have a whole bunch of messages, and even sometimes there might've been a fire. Guess what happened in the time between those messages got sent and when I looked at it? The fire got put out. It was fine. It got solved. Because at the end of the day, if it was that big, my phone would have got blown. They would have called me. You know what I mean? And you start to understand that. I started to learn to protect my time. And so I did it, by that on the days. And like you said, on the weekends, whatever, Friday at 5, sometimes it's earlier. Nothing work until Monday at 10 AM or whenever I go back to it.
So before Matt gets to his, this is actually, we were talking to Mike from, he was used to be at Illinois. He said, reference him as a little short guy. He left Illinois, yep, went to JMU. He's out now, yep. totally done.
Yeah.
So we referenced this story, and I was talking about the guy I worked with at Hofstra. Long story short, he used to be there 1,000 hours a day. And I said to him, I was like, look, you set that expectation. Now all of a sudden, not only do they expect you there, but they don't value exactly. You. Because if you don't value your time, they don't.
Right.
And it's an undercurrent. I think you just hit on it big time of, I agree with you. Balance, you can just be mediocre and everything, but balance to me is being 10 when I need to be 10.
Yeah.
Like when I'm with
exactly.
My
family, yeah.
Like,
yeah, yeah, exactly.
Unless the house is burning down and the kids are in it, right. I don't give a shit.
Right. So, exactly.
You know, but no, I think the big thing, and again, to say it a second time in one night, in two different podcasts, if you don't value your time, no one else does.
Right. Exactly. Right.
So that goes into kind of what I was thinking, which, you know, obviously you guys did an amazing job raising your Series A and Series B. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. By the way. I know
y'all. Thank you.
You're welcome. What has been your best investment for you for under $500? And I know you're big time. You're out there in California. So we'll raise that up to $1,000.
Just a sandwich might be $500.
Yeah, exactly. Man, that's a tough one. I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably every, like, and my wife like kind of wants to kill me on this because I refuse to like get like a Kindle or something where you just download books. I have to have the physical, like, hard copies of them. And like, I'll go to a bookshop on a weekend, although I guess now, like, a lot of them, like, it's harder now, but in normal times, I'll go to a bookshop on a weekend. I'll be there for like 2+ hours just browsing, and I'll come home with, you know, the next 15 books I'm going to read. And she's like, how are you going to like get that one out of, you know? And so I think for me, it's probably just that constant investment of like, I always have, like, I'm never reading a book without the next book already purchased. Because I also think like that kind of keeps me going, where I'm like, I have to get through this book so that I like can read the next one, because I'm excited to read the next one. And I think, like, as we talked about, you know, rebranding, I think that's where my journey to rebrand even started in the first place, was, you know, my first year at Purdue, because I was close with Jeremy Shepherd, I thought I was going to do my PhD with him. In fact, like, we had it all lined up. He agreed to be my, you know, my advisor. And I had just enough of time to pause and be like, man, do I really want to, like, not have a life the next 3 years? And I didn't end up going through with it. And then a few years later, I realized, I was like, man, if I would have just started, I'd be done by now. And then at that time, I was like, well, I think it's probably a good thing I didn't do the PhD in that, because I think it makes more sense to do it in, like, performance psychology, because that's much more transferable. You know, to, like, you could go and advise Fortune 500 companies, you could, you know, whatever. Yeah. And I remember talking to somebody about getting my PhD, and they were like, Josh, yeah, like, you could spend all that money, or you could just pour yourself into it, learn it, and become known for it. And so that's where, like, I started. I never really did much with social media before, and I probably still don't really, but one of the things I started doing, because it also held me accountable, was like book club. So every single book I read, I put it up there. I put like a quote that speaks to me or whatever, and like hashtag book club. But what it did for me was, even internally at Purdue.
So I'm going right here. I was about to reference it because I've stolen yours. And if anyone's listening, find Josh's social media, follow his book clubs. The most recent one I stole from you, the High Growth Handbook, Elad Gill.
Oh, yeah.
So,
great book.
Read that book. It was about February-ish, I think. You know, beginning of the year.
Yeah. COVID,
right? And literally what I'm doing with the business I'm doing it with, where we're at, investments, everything.
Yeah.
I've bought that book now for other people in the business.
Oh, that's amazing.
Because it's so transferable. So
yeah, it is.
So obviously the next question is, obviously the easy question, low hanging fruit is, give me a book, right? So what would you recommend? Yeah. Better question I'm going to follow up with is, young coach starting in the business, give them a book. And then I want, like, mid-30s, give them a book. And then I want one book for older people listening to this podcast, people over 45, 50.
Oh,
50,
man.
Right?
that's tough.
I wouldn't lie to you.
Yeah. No, that's tough. You know, I think a young coach starting out, Because the other thing too is like you got to start to build a habit of reading. So like if you suggest the wrong book, like it might be great, but then it's like tough to get through that book. So it also kind of has to be a fun read
and you meet them with
an easy quick read. So I think Young Coach, I'd say Legacy by James Kerr. It's about the culture of, you know, the New Zealand All Blacks. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of lessons in there that you can apply to coaching, relationships, and also business. And so, you know, that's a book I think is really powerful. That's one of those books that really I think there's value in rereading every single year because it's going to have a slightly different meaning each time you read it. Let's see, in your 30s, you know, I think one, and this is probably just because I read it. I also read it more recently and I wish I would have read it sooner. And it's another, like I read this in basically a day because it was also so captivating is 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if you even have the slightest itch of entrepreneurial, you know, spirit in you at all, you have to read that book. And it's another one where I looked at that and actually Sahil, who is who told me to read it. And as soon as I finished, I told him, I was like, I'm going to read this book every single year because every year, the more I learn and the stage I'm at, it's going to take on a different meaning for me. And then you said like older.
55, 65, like, somewhere there.
Josh, let you think of the older one. One of the best interview questions I ever got being asked to me. And again, in my process mm-hmm. of getting out of strength conditioning, interviewing, I was in New York at Hofstra. I had an opportunity to interview at a big name company in New York. And the woman asked me, so what's your 0 to 1 idea? And to your point, coloring outside the lines and everything.
Yeah.
And the first thing I had to do was look at her and say, I don't know what you mean. And she yeah. looked at me and was like, Peter Thiel with like, she gave me that look like, the hell did yeah. how do you not know what I mean? And yeah. I, again, it was a moment for me to be like, okay, one, like I know that name, didn't know the concept. So I couldn't answer the question. So she sits there and she goes, what's the idea you have that everyone else would think is stupid, but it's actually a really mm-hmm. good idea?
Yeah, yeah. So
I sat there and I hit her with this idea that I had and why I was on the interview and how I got to that point. And she looked at me and she goes, wow. She goes, that was a really good answer. She goes, but she goes, you didn't know what the question was. So you're kind of not in the conversation anymore because it shows that you don't understand kind of the current climate.
And oh, wow.
Yeah. So I actually lost the possibility of working for this place because I didn't really know what 0 to 1 was and I didn't understand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I knew who Peter Thiel was, but I didn't know what he, you know. So yeah. again, it's one of those things. I anytime someone references that, it brings me back to that kick in the ass, but it was a learning lesson for me. Not only branch out, but learn more. And to your point, I've read that book now 3 times.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, it's an incredible book. Yeah. And that's like a Peter Thiel question. Like that's like the question that he asks is like, mm-hmm. basically what's the most contrarian, you know, thing that you believe to be true that everyone else thinks you're crazy. In fact, Rishi asked me that very question, my CEO, when he was interviewing me. So going back, the last book, and this is hard, man, because all I do is read. So it's like you could give me genres and all, like, you know, but keeping it open ended. Again, this is one it's probably a cop out because I also read it within the last year. But I think it's a super powerful book. It would probably be and Joe, you'll have to help me with this because I'm blanking on the title. Bob Iger's book. Disney CEO.
Yeah. Hold on.
I'm blanking on the title.
The one about how their movies always suck when they first come in, right? And then they end up going through and making them into different things completely than where they started.
So this one follows more his journey. You might be thinking of Creativity Inc., which is another phenomenal one. About like Pixar journey. Ride of a Lifetime. That's it.
Is the newest one.
And that and it's one. Yeah, that's the one. And it's you know, it's Bob Iger's journey throughout his career from, you know, the dude started his career as like a some type of like production assistant for not even ABC. Like I forget what it was. Something.
No, you know, it was ultimately. He was the self-described, like, I remember this. He was like a grunt. Mm-hmm. He was below the mail boy or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And he just, you know, he continued, you know, I think it's a story of like showing up. It's a story of relationships. It's a story of like failure and leadership and culture. But also like probably why I say that is like, the most impressive things that he's done in his 50s and, you know, I don't know how old he is. I think he's maybe approaching 70 or early 60s or something. And like the most impressive things he's done has been later in his life and career. And quite honestly, he probably even hasn't even yet done the most impressive thing that he will do. And just his leadership style, his journey. He talks very openly about his failures. It's amazing book. Another quick read, another fun read. So,
no, I love it. You pretty much crushed all three. And I know I gave it wide open, but I like to ask who have those, you know, huge libraries. Like if somebody asked me for a financial book, I know the two or three I would go with. So I like asking that open-ended question because then you're like, oh, crap. Exactly. No, you crushed everything, man. This has been extremely great. We obviously let you run for long periods of time just because you had so much awesome information, and hopefully pulled out a few nuggets. And I'm excited to go through this and watch us again and kind of pull out more and more for sure. So I appreciate your time, man. Thank you.
No, man, I appreciate it as always. It's fun and appreciate you guys giving me a platform.
No, I appreciate you, man. And like I said, like we all share that common, you know, high tide raises all boats. And if I can give back, and I know Matt and I know yourself, it's easy to put three people together in a room and try and at least, I mean, hell, between the three of us, we got to know something. I mean, it may not be good.
Yeah, exactly.
Try to help the next person.
Exactly.